Yeah, so hello everyone, hello Vlad. So I will present you today a talk which is a bit different than usually. So I will not talk only about my results, but I will focus, because of this program here, I will focus how, we can use the observation and somehow get closer, speaking of observations and theory. So I will mainly focus on the dust continuum emissions of, for example, which is now observed with ALMA, which is even resolved, and then say a little bit also about the line emissions. So the first part will be, okay, what do we see? And you see from the stars, this will be thermal dust emission. What do we model, which is actually the gas dust? And well, then finally, what do we understand? And from these two footnotes, you can already estimate what will be the answer. But just, very simple sketch. So this is outdated, just that we are all on the same page. Sketch of the protoplanetary disk. So let's start on the left with the gas, which is hot enough, ionized enough to allow for the magnetorotation instability. At some point, the temperatures drop. The dust can now condense. This is what we call here the inner rim. Here, most of the irradiation is absorbed and re-emitted in the near infrared, which can be traced here with current telescopes. Then we expect to have these long extended dead zones. So here the magnetic fields are decoupled from the gas flow. And because of the lower turbulence, we also expect that the dust disk, which is here in brown, has a smaller height, vertical height. And if you go far out again, the densities get low enough, so cosmic ray ionization takes over. So here, at some point, we would expect the MRI turbulence to work again. And the outer parts are now interesting because now ALMA can even resolve here the dusty disk. So it's able to capture here the thermal radiation from the dust in the submillimeter. So I will focus first on this part, and let's talk about what do we actually observe. So you all know this famous picture of HL tau, which shows these nice ring structures. And there are now additional observations where we see ring structure in different systems, in GW Hydra, here HG6 in 3296. But now, just to give you a brief intro, so what do we actually see? I mean, we see a flux, right? But now, if you have only a single wavelength and you see such a picture, I mean, you don't know what is causing these drops. I mean, it can be if it's optical sig, for example. So if you look at the dusty disk, which is somewhere around here, so this is the gas, the dust. So if it's optical sig, the only thing what you see is the temperature. So meaning if you have only one wavelength and you see that, then you could also ask, well, perhaps we see temperature variations. So therefore, it's very important to look at different wavelength, and capture where this becomes optical thin. Because if it's optical thin, you are not only sensitive to the temperature, you are sensitive to the whole column of the surface density of the dust and the temperature. Therefore, it's really important. For this image, they choose three wavelengths, so from 0.87 to 1.6 and 2.9 millimeter with ALMA. And they combine these to make this image. And if you have these three wavelengths, then you can start to look, in which regime we are, if the gaps are, optical thin or sig, so how these gaps are caused. But this is very important to take away, because by definition, you don't know what causes these gaps in the emission flux. So I will now show a plot from Christoph Pinte. So he took the sample of the ALMA observation and made a radiation transfer modeling. And even more, he tried to estimate the optical gap. And this is very difficult. You have to know the opacity, the source, right? You have to know the temperature. But I mean, he made a good effort, and he estimated here for the three different bands the optical depth. What you can see, well, it's marginally optical sig. So this makes the modeling even more harder because you are in a transition, where not only temperature matters, but the surface density as well, and the grain sizes as well. So for example, you see here that the optical depth drops at these gaps to a value of around 2.3. So these are upper limits. So because the the gaps are always convolved, you know, with the beam size. They also show some emission from the side views. So that means they cannot really say how deep is this gap.
Why is the optical depth lower at longer wavelengths?
So, it's simple because at longer wavelengths, dust grains have, the number density of dust grains is lower, right? If they grow, you know, number density gets lower, and the opacity strongly drops, you know, with the grain size distribution. So, and then for longer wavelengths, the resolution is bad, right? But again, it gets more and more optical thin. For example, at 7 millimeter, it's completely optical thin at VLA wavelengths.
Sorry, but what kind of model is it? What is it?
So this is
the basic model.
Yes. So this is the basic underlying model is here a dusty disk. So you take a reference grain size, let's say 1 millimeter. You say it has this opacity and this temperature, and then you can start to think, you know, what causes these gaps. And usually what they do is, well, they say it cannot be temperature, you know, because we know it's somehow smooth. So they model it with a surface density variation, so the surface density in 1 millimeter grains variations. And then they say what we see here, it's probably variations of the surface density of this 1 millimeter grains. But this is only a model. Again, I mean, different models can explain the same figure, right? So, okay. So, well, the bottom line was that, you know, that we see most of the emission is in the quasi-optical thick regime. So, but what you really want is optical thin emission, because only then you can really constrain, you know, surface density and temperature, because at this point you only see a temperature for the bright rings. So that is really what we need. So, and you see in this whole range in the bottom, there's not much there. So that was the motivation, you know, to observe H and tau with VLA, which is here in 7 millimeter. And this here I overplot already, you know, in yellow the VLA 7 millimeter contour, which is resolved here, and it shows actually that this bright ring of which was very smooth, you know, at around 1 millimeter, it becomes now clumpy. So that means because we are now getting really optical thin, now you trace, you know, variations in the dust density. So now you can make some you know, interpretation about the dust in the disk. So this is again very important, because if it's optical thick, you only see temperature variations.
And the UV coverage is good enough that we can believe all that structure?
That's a good question. So there's a long discussion in the paper. So this was published by Carlos Gonzalez, and they claim it's good enough. You have to be careful. I mean, even the ALMA image itself, right? You have to be careful which features are real. But, well, normally the people say if you see a ring, that's probably real. But if you see some small variations along azimuth, you have to be careful because of the UV coverage. That's true. But in this case, I think it's because it's optically thin and shows a well clear structure, I think it should be fine. Okay, so this figure is a bit more difficult. So this is now a different radiation transfer modeling, similar to the one from Christoph Pinte. And with this figure, I want to show the spectral index. So you see, spectral index shows you the slope of the emission flux over wavelength. So this is interesting, because if you are in the optical thin regime, then you can learn from this slope, you know, for example, about the grain size. Of course, different grain sizes are sensible to different wavelengths. So one important thing to note here is that, so if you have grain size A, and normally times 2 pi, this is sensitive to the wavelength. So this is, for example, for ALMA, this means, you know, if you look at 1 millimeter wavelength, you are really sensitive to the 200 micron dust grains in the disk. And we know these grains are large, you know, they settle, they show, you know, drift. And this is, therefore, we can use now here the spectral index to really get some information about the grain size distribution, also where they are enriched or depleted in the disk. So you see, another thing to mention, so for optical thick emission, this spectral index is 2, which is here indicated, you know, if you take the spectral index for the ALMA bands. So you see to reach this close to 2 for the inner disk. But now with the 7 millimeter emission, you can take the 3 and the 7 millimeter, and you get some sort of constraints on the larger cranes. And in fact, what it tells us here, that the larger cranes are probably enriched in the inner disk and depleted from the outer one. And this is what we expect, you know, because larger cranes drift, so they're very, very fast, they should, you know, drift inward and enrich the inner disk. So this is one interesting result, but again, you really need optical thin emission, therefore we want to go to these longer wavelengths. Okay, now I will ask a question, you know, can we connect these crane sizes to the turbulence? So this is tricky. So there's a nice plot here from Till Binchel from 2012. This is dust coagulation model, so it shows you crane size over radius. The density, so the contour color is some sort of local dust density. So you see here how the cranes, you know, evolve with size and radius. And the four different snapshots, they change the underlying turbulence level. So here you have a classical alpha Shakur-Hansen-Yahalf level of 10 to minus 2, 10 to minus 3, 4, 5. So there are two important informations from this result. First, look at the solid line and the dashed line. So dashed line, it's called the drift barrier. So meaning, if you have two cranes in the disk, so one which is small, one which is large, so larger one should drift faster. So there is a relative velocity between those two, and therefore they fragment. So that means they cannot grow over this barrier. So this is here indicated by this dashed line. The solid line shows you the fragmentation barrier from the turbulence itself. So, and the nice thing is that if you have a very turbulent disk, then you really constrain the largest size, you know, for which you are sensitive with ALMA. But for the all other cases, you see that the largest grains, they are limited by the drift barrier, actually. So meaning that we know that the disks are not fully turbulent there, so probably it will not help us, you know, to search for the largest grain size because they are limited by the drift in any case. So. But there's a hope if you look at the here at the small cranes. Because if you lower the turbulence, you know, you don't have the source of small cranes anymore. And that means that you get a strong depletion of small cranes. Of course, you know, the ALMA and VLA are not sensitive to small cranes, but this would be a way to get some hint about the turbulence itself. So that for the larger cranes, it would be really difficult.
Sorry, I thought the drift barrier, they mean that they grow, so they drift faster than they can grow.
It's two barriers, actually. It's the drift faster to the star than they can grow. But even if you forget about it, the relative velocity between two cranes causes a fragmentation barrier, which is also called the drift barrier here. So this is really a fragmentation barrier by the drift, you know, because the two different cranes, you know, drift with different velocities. But this is a good point. There are two different drift barriers. So what I want to say is, you know, that if you want to see turbulence by small cranes, you have to look at the shorter wavelengths in scattered light, you know, because there's no way we could get some constraints from ALMA or VLA here, because the largest cranes are really limited by the drift. Okay, so let's try another way. So what about the vertical scale height? Because we know, you know, turbulence is pushing up this crane, so could we learn here something? So again, I switch papers back to Christoph Pinte. He tried to model this ALMA image, assuming now, again, you know, a single dust grain, 1 millimeter, and now trying to change the vertical scale height of the dust. So you see it here on the top. He uses two different alpha values, no settling at all in the ALMA image, and somehow he claims that the best fit model is with an alpha Shakur-Hansen-Yahalf to 10 to minus 4. But you have to be really careful, because this alpha doesn't tell you anything about the whole disk alpha, because the dust scale height is really small. It's orders of magnitude below the gas disk scale height. That means what this trace is the alpha value at the midplane. And actually, we know from stratified, you know, turbulence models, at the midplane, the alpha can be quite small. So this, if you see this picture, well, I would say the total alpha is probably much higher, because it really traces only the midplane, let's say, vertical diffusion, which, you know, is sensitive to the large cranes. So this is a very important thing to keep in mind. because this also somehow doesn't rule out MRI turbulence, you know, because we have models where alpha can be smaller at mid-plane.
Is this an upper bound or is it an actual value?
So it's a good question. Well, I think, well, he tried to see the fit the brightness profile for different alphas, you know, which some sort of change the dust scale height. And well, he says it's 10 to minus 4. I think, you know, well, this is, would be the upper limit, right, where you have...
But let's see. Is alpha equals something large.
Right, very large. So that's a good point. He hasn't... Probably you're right. Probably here. And lower alpha could work, but that's something we should
ask. I don't remember. Yeah. I'm just wondering if it's compatible with, like, no turbulence at all.
That's a good question, yeah. Should ask him.
Well, if you can measure the age of dust, right, the scale height of the dust, given the Stokes number, you can measure the scale height of the gas.
Right.
And that gives you the temperature. But you can actually get the temperature from the observations.
So they get the temperature from the continuum mission anyway, right?
So
you
can actually do it the other way around, and then from the temperature tell what the scale height of the gas is. You have the scale height of the dust, you can tell the Stokes number, which then gives you information on the gas density.
Yes, that's actually a good point. Yeah, that would be possible. You're right. If they know the Stokes number and the because of the settling and the temperature, they could constrain, you know, what has to be the gas density to fulfill it. That's actually a good point.
And the gas density that they get, does it make sense?
Yes. I'm not sure now, but I guess they take the usual, you know, 10 to minus 2 dust to gas mass ratio and then calculate, you know, a dust density which is quasi optical thick, you know, they know the opacity, so that they can from the other way, right, they can check the surface density of the gas. But you're right, that would be one way to determine the gas density. Okay, so that was, you know, just one try so just to summarize, you know, well, we can see turbulence directly in the bulk of the disk. And I would say the current best fit radiation transfer models doesn't rule out the MRI turbulence. And it's really the key to understand this is really the grain size distribution, because then we could make some link to the turbulence. I mean, again, this is for the dust terminal emission, you know, for the ALMA and VLA observations.
But if you see turbulence, how do you know this MRI turbulence? And not just turbulence.
Yeah, it can be any turbulence. Yeah, yeah. I'm just because I'm interested in MRI, so it can be any. You're right. Okay, what do we want? So I will present two simulations which are published here. One in 2015. These are global 3D stratified non-ideal MHC simulations with the Pluto code. We use here a vertical net flux field, so ohmic resistivity which depends on ionization and dust chemistry. And we use radiation transfer best fit, you know, initial conditions, which are taken from actual observations. So the surface density has a 1 over R profile of 6 gram at 100 AU. And then we calculate the radiation hydrostatic solution here to show you the temperature. So there is a strong, vertical temperature gradient in the vertical. And these are some sort of initial conditions. And then you apply, you know, a vertical magnetic field on it. And the MRI will quickly, you know, set in. Here, a plot of the magnetic Reynolds number, NOC 10. So you see 1,000 is around here and reaches even unity, you know, very deep here in the disk. And this we would call then the dead zone. You know, here we would not see any sort of big coupling. So we let this. We made also a reference model where there's no ohmic resistivity at all, so the disk is fully turbulent. So this shows the toroidal magnetic field in milligauss, and the color gives you also some indications about the sign. But then, if you switch on the, you know, the more realistic ohmic dissipation profile, you see in this inner disk, you know, fields get more smooth. You have this sign transition at the borders of the dead zone, so strong current sheets, and then in the outer part it's more large scale turbulence again. So we let this run for many of hundreds of orbits. And then we found an interesting result. We found like alternating states. So this plot shows you here the surface density phase on, and you see this. Quickly, a gap and jump structure evolved. And actually, the jump was strong enough, you know, and low magnetized enough that the Rossby wave instability could set in and cause here the generation of a vortex. So we had two, like a ring state for one third of the time and a vortex state for two third of the time. And these things were, you know, the vortex itself was at some point destroyed because the Rossby wave instability, you know, dampens the surface density jump. And the MRI, you know, which was active in the gap and in the outer part, was trying to push up this jump again. So this was caused due to a feedback of the MRI on the density change. So the MRI was very active in the gap because of the lower density, but then LSSM numbers drop, you know, inside the high density ring. So there was something like a feedback loop here. So this was interesting because, you know, our aim was, you know, if we could observe this with ALMA, and that was possible, so we saw this formation of a gap and ring structure, and we could also make some, you know, conclusion to which state we would see more often. As the next step, we included, you know, a gas track, so different grain sizes which feel gas tracks, so which undergo settling and drift. Here, a result which was here published by Ruge et al. 2016. So there was a clear sign that, you know, the ring here is strong enough that it allows for dust trapping. So particles, you know, which are larger, so above a millimeter, they are quickly drifting really inward, and then they are trapped in this ring structure. And in the case where the vortex was present, you know, these particles could be also able to be trapped by the vortex, and you see, you know, larger grains are much more concentrated inside the vortex. And then we used this model to calculate, you know, radiation transfer post-processing. So we took here the image, put it in the ALMA-Kassel simulator, and then measured here the variations of the brightness in the gap and ring. So, and it was nice that we could really resolve these, you know, variations with ALMA, so simulate really realistic observation.
Why did you rotate that by 45 degrees?
Well, that's a good question. I have to ask Jan Philipp. I have no idea. He had something in mind, I'm pretty sure he told me, but okay, yeah. So, well, yeah, the summary here was, you know, that it was that this dust trapping and so was then, you know, increasing the opacity locally, and we were really able to with ALMA to resolve this gap and jump structure. And also, you know, and we could also explain some azimuthal variations in the emission, which is, you know, sometimes seen in observations.
How wide are these rings compared to vertical scale height?
So they are around, let's say, two disk scale heights broad. Mm-hmm. And the vertical scale height of the gas in this case was around 0.1, perhaps a bit smaller. So. That was it was let's say, so at 60 AU you have something like 12 AU broad, so it was barely resolved with ALMA. Okay, now, you know, I want to go back because this was really important. You know, I mentioned this, you know, alpha roughly 10^-4. I took the same model which I showed now, you know, calculated the turbulent velocity in the vertical direction, and then made here a map, you know. And it's very interesting because at the midplane we reach waves of 1% of the sound speed, which would reflect into a mixing alpha, you know, for the dust grains of 10^-4. So that's what I wanted to say. You know, it doesn't. I mean, the HL tau image doesn't rule out, you know, some you know, MHD activity like we have it here. Okay, now let's make a big step. So I will now jump to explain these green lines here. So this are this should be reflect, you know, line observation. So if you are the observer and you look, you know, to the top of the disk, you know, depending on the line opacity, you know, if it's 100 cm² per gram or 0.1, you treat, you know, different regions in the disk. So here with optical thick line, you know, you would see very strong turbulence. With you know, a more optical thin line, you would be more sensitive to the bulk emission of the disk. But there's one thing which is really important to mention. So it's really difficult, you know, to measure a turbulent broadening component in the line emission. So there was a nice paper here by Richard Teague, 2016. So So he mentioned that, I mean, I quoted him here, you know, that even if you make everything perfect and you have a perfect disk phase on and you see everything right, that just from the flux calibration alone, the error which propagates through the whole process, you probably are limited to turbulent velocities which are above 7% of the sound speed. So it's really hard, you know, with line observation to resolve such a low level of turbulence. So I just asked him, you know, yesterday in the mail, what would you need, you know, to resolve, you know, 1% of the sound speed? And well, he tells me, you know, you have to know the temperature really in a promille accuracy. I mean, and that is really hard to get. There's another limitation that, you know, because you look, you know, through the disk, you see different temperature regions. So it's like, you know, integral for different temperature regions. And all these different temperature regions gives you, again, a different broadening signal. So you see, to extract the mid-plane value, so it would be really tough. So I'm not sure in the next years if we will be able, you know, to resolve such a low, you know, turbulent velocity, so like something like a dead zone in the line emission.
Sorry, I understand the limit from optically thin emission in multiple layers, but why is this absolute flux calibration? Why does flux calibration prevent you from measuring broadening?
Yeah, so he told me that, you know, if you take the whole process and you propagate the error, then you get at the end, you know, an error in the turbulent velocity. You know, even if you perfectly know your temperature and you have the profile and you have all the components, that it translates into this value. So I mean, this is only one limitation. The other limitation is if you don't exactly know your temperature profile, you know, you also get has much more problems to get this accurate value.
So he uses both the width and the intensity of the line for the model.
Yes, yeah. So this is really something we have to in mind, so that I think it will be really hard to get down. I mean, there are multiple problems here, not only the flux calibration, it's really also the temperature, which you have to know very accurately. Okay, another point, polarization. Perhaps here we could see something, you know, from magnetic fields. So you know, just for the reference, so if you have cranes, you know, which are not perfectly spherical, they align with the magnetic fields, and then in the absorption, you can see a polarization signal which is along the field lines. If it's in the emission, you know, submillimeter, like for the ALMA, for example, it would be, you know, rotated by 90 degrees. So here we would expect, you know, that if they align with the magnetic field, you know, you see a signal which is 90 degree rotated. And for the scattering, it's a bit different because here radiation torque aligns the cranes, and then you would see a circular pattern. So, and for that, you know, what we want to do is here the emission in the submillimeter. So there was last year by Gesa Bertrand, she took my models, so which I showed, and she calculated the polarized continuum emission we would see with ALMA. It's in the sort of 10%, the absolute value of the polarization degree. And what you see here nicely is this radial structure, which is caused by the dominant toroidal field. Because it's, you know, the emission, it's rotated by 90 degrees. So this is what you would expect. But now, as always, you know, there was a nice work here by Kadaoka-san, which showed that self-scattering might produce exactly the same structure. So if you have an anisotropic radiation field, then the dust grains itself can, you know, scatter their own thermal emission. And then you would expect the same, you know, pattern. So there was even, you know, recently an ALMA observation who showed this nice pattern, you know, and I was like, well, you know, looks very nice, but still you cannot rule out, you know, what is causing it. Is it really toroidal fields or is it self-scattering? So this has to be still answered in the future.
And the self-scattering gets up to 10% still?
That's a good point. So in the self-scattering case, it's actually 3%. And well, it's as always, right? In the paper, they write, you know, this is self-scattering. I mean, in the paper by Kadaoka-san, because he presented the model of self-scattering and got the ALMA time. So he doesn't, you know, contradict his own paper. But I wrote him, you know, and said, hey, well, it's not 3%, it's 10%. So, but, you know, he says, well, perhaps it's a combination of both. So you see it. But you're right, they should be away from the degree, perhaps, to get something. And actually, you know, the recent observation was closer to the 10%. So they had something like, you know, it was something like 12% in this direction, and which is closer, you know, and then bit lower. So, but this is again still a current, you know, investigation. So.
Sorry, I don't know anything about this, but what sets the degree in the emission case? It's the degree of ellipticity of the grains, or just how well they align, or what's the?
That's a good question. I'm not fully sure about that, so that I have to check. I think it doesn't. It's not so sensitive, you know, how elongated those are. But yeah, but it's more common, you know. From the models I know, it doesn't go above 10%. So.
And also, I think people really don't understand how grains can align in this case, because much higher density environment, and they can. Given that field strength and given that density, it's very likely that they. It's also likely that they may never align.
It's yeah. That's
possible, basically.
That's true. Yeah.
You might be following the Kaplan rotation, because most of the drift is actually in the Kaplan. The azimuthal direction. So you might be probing. This thing is telling you that, well, you have Kaplan or near Kaplan rotation. Mm-hmm.
But you have to calculate the local, you know, which torque is the strongest, the radiation or the.
For the densities which are the one you expect here, it's not clear that the magnetic torque is going to dominate.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. So therefore, I wanted to also show, you know, different options. So it's always a sum between radiation torque, you know, and magnetic torque. So. Okay, but you know, I will say so. Please correct me if you know other. But I think for now there's no observational evidence for magnetic fields at all in protoplanetary disks. So and this is, you know, you see that we have really to proceed here to get anything. Okay. Now let's make a big jump, so to the inner disk. So I was talking here about the outer disk, which is more or less, you know, optical thin in the submillimeter. So let's focus now if we can learn something about this inner region, because here there's most of the near infrared emission. It's optical thick. It's also dust thermal emission. It's smaller grains. But what about this region? So the inner rim, it's a bit like, you know, a snow line of the silicate. So 50% of the solid material will sublimate in this region, and the rim position depends on the luminosity of the stars. It can be between 0.01 or 1 AU, and sublimation temperatures are in the order of 1200 to 1500 Kelvin. So the typical idea in 2010 was here presented by a review by Becky Stulemund. You have the gas disk, a lot of radiation is absorbed in this inner rim and then re-emitted in the near infrared. And then there was still a discussion ongoing, you know, is this rim round? How large is this shadow? You know, and the big question was, you know, what's causing the near infrared excess? Because from you know, classical radiation hydrostatic models, they cannot explain the near infrared excess in some of the Herbig stars. And here there was some solutions represented, you know, either by a disk wind, which, you know, lifts up some dust material, or magnetic fields, which you know, pushes up the inner rim height of the disk. So we also wanted to investigate that. So there was here a recent paper we published. So these are 3D radiation non-ideal MHD models. So there's a lot of physics involved. Irradiation by the star, thermal cooling by the disk with flux limit diffusion. We include dust sublimation and deposition, and couple here the sublimation temperature to the dust opacity. We include zero net and vertical magnetic fields and ohmic dissipation, which depends on temperature to mimic here the thermal ionization. So this is the grid and spherical grid size and domain. And the only input parameter are really this parameter of the star, you know, surface temperature, mass and radius of the star, and the mass accretion rate, and then the initial magnetic field. And these four alone give you a 2D radiation hydrostatic solution, which you can then extend to 3D with an initial magnetic field. So for the model I present, we choose a Herbig star, you know, with a 10,000 Kelvin surface temperature and 2.5 solar mass and 2.5 solar radius, and a mass accretion rate of 10 to minus 8 solar mass per year. So this is a picture of some, you know, steady state. Shows you the volume rendering of the dust density. I will now make the light. So you see here, like, three important regimes. So the cutoff, the inner rim. So this is low density dust, which is turbulent. The dead zone inner edge roughly starts here. Then you have an increase in surface density, you know, to balance the drop in accretion, because here the stresses are reduced. And at some point here you have also a dust trap, you know, because of this this rise in surface density, you know, you will trap, you know, pebbles of, you know, centimeter and meter sizes. And then in the next plot, I show you the stress to pressure ratio, you know, which is here calculated for the full disk and then averaged over azimuth, so in C over R and radius. Again, the rim position, you know, this is the integral of the, you know, radiation, you know, where it reaches the tau 1. So it's something like a tau 1 surface for the radiation absorption. And then another important line is the MRI damping line, so the Elsässer number unity line. But what this tells you is, you know, you have quite some fraction of dust in this high turbulent regime. So this is interesting because here, you know, it would also limit the high turbulent velocities would limit the dust growth very, very efficiently. Yes, and then you see also in the Detson well, it quickly drops to very low values.
What is disk scale height?
So the disk scale height is, in this case, between 0.03 and 0.04. So it's really thin. So
in the inner part, the alpha value is pretty much constant of interest, right?
That's correct. So this is pretty much the integrated alpha. It's around a bit higher than 10 to minus 2, and then quickly drops. And what I have mentioned, so this system is still considered something like a passive disk, because the optical depth here doesn't, and so for this model, it doesn't reach a point, you know, where the accretion stress is here trapped. And this is also due to the case that, you know, well, the highest, you know, optical depth you would have here, but there's no accretion stress there. So most of the accretion stress will be able to, you know, dissipate, and the heat will be able to leave the disk on a short time scale.
You said you have dust sublimation and deposition. What does that mean, and how does it reflect here?
So what is the meaning of that?
Yeah.
So, okay, let me write there. So, so it's like the integrate from 6 times the stellar radius to the region, let's call it R tau. And then you calculate, you know, the kappa times the density times dr. So once this is some sort of the tau, and once tau reaches, you know, unity, you absorb most of the radiation, it gets very cool, and then the dust is able to condense and to form. And this provides you then the source of opacity. But it's a very tough problem, you know, because you have to consider a lot of, you know, let's say iterations. You know, it's not like which you just set in as a setup. I mean, we first published here a 2D paper where we present the method how to derive this profile, because, you know, these profiles, I mean, can easily, you know, change or vary, especially at the beginning. So normally what you do is, you know, you start with a very optical thin disk, you know, with a low surface density, then you slowly increase it, and then you see how this rim structure converges to a given position. Because, I mean, everything is here important. Even, you know, the back irradiation from the wall itself, you know, if you hear dust grain, you feel like the stellar heating, you feel the heating by the rim, you see. So it's a very complex problem.
So in terms of m dot, since you have an alpha which is pretty large and it is alpha integrated vertically, which is very small,
yes.
Does it mean that you are going to empty the disk and then you end up with the truncated stuff? Or how would this evolve in time?
Mm-hmm. So that's a good question. So for the initial conditions, we assumed alpha of 10 to minus 3 in the dead zone, which is not true. So meaning, you know, in if you should take it, this is not an inflow equilibrium anymore in the 3D case. So if now the way would be, you know, to go back to 2D, you know, use this alpha, but then you can imagine, I mean, the surface density would, I mean, be 3 orders of magnitude higher, which would be the GI unstable regime. So, well, the bottom line is we don't trust our stress in the dead zone because it's only omic, and, you know, there are different things which could go on. So therefore, you know, we made like an approach, you know, to say, well, the alpha is 10 to minus 3, perhaps by some alpha turbulence, and then you get you know, the order of magnitude jump in surface density. But you're right, so this would, at this point, you know, it would be not inflow equilibrium. So, okay. So let's now look at the near-infrared access. So we took this model, we post-processed it, and we wanted to answer the question, you know, how does this whole structure, this MRI, this MHD, change the near-infrared access, you know, compared to the hydrodynamical model. So this is like the flux normalized over the radiation hydro model over wavelength. And these results here show two models, one where we use a zero net flux case, and one where we use a vertical magnetic field, so net flux case. And only in the net flux case, you know, you had enough, you know, magnetic pressure, you know, to puff up, you know, the upper layers of the disk and to increase here the near-infrared absorbing surface, you know. So that that was telling us, well, perhaps it's more likely that this, you know, near-infrared, you know, excess we see in observations perhaps caused by a or could be caused by a vertical magnetic field. But it also tells you that the vertical field alone doesn't help. You would still, I mean, sometimes, you know, the excess is a factor of two, you know, so you would still need some other component, which could be a wind or something else. But yeah, one interesting point was that with this, you know, weak magnetization, there was no way we could get this increase in the near-infrared. Okay. Some other things which appeared. It was again the Ross wave instability acting because there was again this surface density bump. Here I show the dust density phase on at the for a given height. So you see this over density here, and we could also check, you know, how this increase in the local density it will push up the vertical height, you know, of the irradiation absorption by around 10%. So what we would expect is, you know, that this thing would cast a shadow to the outer disk under a given angle. So synthetic images, we took the models, used the Monte Carlo radiation transfer, and then, you know, for a given inclination and three different wavelengths, which we map to blue, green, and red, we then can create these images. You know, they help to understand where, you know, which wavelength comes from which regions. In this case, it tells you that most of the emission, which traces really the inner rim surface, is around 4.8 micron, whereas at smaller wavelengths, they really trace only very narrow regime in radius. And for the 3D case, this is, you know, we simulated only 90 degrees, so don't look at the M4 mode. but what I wanted to show here is that even in the, you know, thermal emission, this vortex feature was, you know, changing the structure. There was something like arc feature, you know, visible in the near infrared. Then, just for reference, scattered light, how would this look? So we choose here 0.3 micron, which is the peak emission of the Herbig star, and then in log scale of the intensity, and you see this, you know, shadowing structures here. So this was, you know, what I said before, that this variations of the height can really cause some shadowing effects onto the outer disk. Okay, one important result is the last thing. This is variability. So we took, you know, the full, we measured the full SED over time, and then you can pick up, you know, certain wavelengths. And I told you already, you know, at around 4.8 you trace the inner rim surface, so that we know. Then you can look how does it evolve over time. And this light curve variations here, let's focus on the 4.8. It shows you some periodic feature and then it gets more irregular. So this was clearly due to the vortex, you know, because the vortex perturbs strongly the disk. But more interesting are these periodic features. So this we could really trace back on the MRI dynamo. So 10 local orbital variations. So we saw this correlates perfectly with the mean toroidal field, which is generated and which pushes up and down the inner rim surface. So I think Oliver will tell us more on Thursday about that. But this is really interesting because this would be a way, you know, from the light curve to trace back onto an MHD turbulence. So from variations of this light curve, you know, of 4.8 micron. And with this, I close and I will go to what do we really understand. So, well, current observation constraints don't confirm or rule out, I think, MHD turbulence. And also, I want to stress here that estimating detailed turbulent velocities will be really difficult, also, even for the current telescope facilities. And perhaps the light curve variations would give us here some more clues in the future. Thank you for your attention.
don't you see QPOs?
Well, I mean, he does see QPOs.
My colleagues believe that when you have a disk and a Christian, you must have QPOs. So something is. I'm joking.
The problem is, we don't have long enough light curves. I mean, so the orbital period of the disk inner edge is a week or something at the sublimation front. And there was recently a big campaign with Koro and Warm Spitzer, and so they managed to get 40 days and 40 nights, so four orbits. So it's very different from the situation with compact systems.
So look, all hope is lost.
There are some things that could be quasi-periodic, but people are not saying that there's a peak yet in the power spectrum.
So
what were the amplitude of the variations that you were predicting?
So it was not too much. You see,
oh, it's a couple of percent
variations. It's more.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. You have more, but this you can understand because the toroidal field, you know, only slightly puffs up this rim surface. So that's true.
So probably set it, like take it in. When you do your energy simulations, you put in some magnetic field, or earth field, or.
Yes, so it's so what we use is we take the vector potential, you know, and we put in for the zero net flux case, we let then, you know, calculate the code, you know, the vertical field to be sure that it's B free, but it's already a turbulent, you know, field, vector potential field. So this, you know, we do that to avoid this normally strong, you know, linear phase of the MRI, which would perturb this too much, and which would cause, you know, the absorption surface to vary too strong. So for the radiation, you know, that's a bit, you know, it's a bit sensitive. So, but for the vertical field case, I mean, we just use combination actually, you know, of vertical field plus this vector potential.
And does the vertical field evolve within your simulation?
It evolves, and it was actually very tough, you know, because in the vertical case you have much stronger turbulence, you know. The simulation needs much more, you know, because your alpha speeds are higher. So we couldn't really see, you know, we couldn't really simulate over long cycles, right? So, but we see it's evolving, you know, we trace even the evolution. So therefore we conclude in the paper that, well, we are focusing more on the zero net flux case, because here we are sure, right, that it's not, that it's more or less in a steady state.
I'd like to come back to the second point in your conclusion, where you say that it's difficult to estimate velocities of 1% of CS level. There is at least one paper claiming that they can do that. This is this paper by Flaherty and Meredith-Hughes and others. So what do you think it's there's a modeling problem here, or what's your opinion?
So, well, I spoke with Stefan Guillotot from Bordeaux and with Richard Teague, and both are experts in the modeling, and they told me, no, I mean, it's not possible. I mean, they assume that they know the temperature to accuracy, you know, which is not the case, or they neglect any other, you know, let's say modeling, you know, or error propagation. But, you know, if you really, I mean, won't include all the errors and make it really, you know, proper, then, I mean, that's what Richard Teague published. So it's really hard to get this limit. So they say that it's not possible what the other claim, you know, to be able to resolve.
Teague seemed to have done a fairly thorough job as far as I can tell. So they considered one optically thick transition, another one that has fine structure in it so they can get the temperature.
Right.
And then a third one that they can then combine with one of the others, and assuming that their distributions in the disk are similar, and they can also get the temperature. And the three give answers that are different enough that they say you can't really tell the strength of the turbulence.
Another thing I recall is that Richard Teague uses a non-parametric model. So to fit the non-parametric model, they get temperature at every point. And Kevin Flaherty's group, they are using, well, Meredith Hughes' group, they are using a parametric model. They have they assume certain temperature profile, density profile, Yes, and also some vertical structure is also assumed with certain parameters, and they find, I think, no turbulence gives you basically a reasonable fit.
Yeah.
I
was wondering about the vertex. So I can go back to show the slide. So last time we talked about it, you said that you didn't see
a vertex in the model. So what changes it?
Well, we haven't run it long enough. So, so because you know you need something like 20 local orbits at one AU, right?
Yeah.
So it was appearing at a later stage. And also, of course, you need the at least the 90 degree, right? I mean, if you are below, you don't resolve that vortex. So.
Yeah, you would need at least the M equal 5.
Right. Yeah.
Movement.
Right.
Is what the lifetime of this thing would be?
That's a good question. So, well, in the paper, you know, we saw that it's very elongated. You know that, I mean, Geoffroy, I think you worked on something like where you estimate the lifetime of, you know, the elliptical instability, how it destroys the vortex, right? Or flat U as well. But anyway, we claim, you know, that it's likely that it's destroyed quite rapidly if you have higher resolution. But we are not able, you know, to resolve internal structure of the vortex. So that's a good point. But we cannot address that, how long is the lifetime.
So maybe worth mentioning another observational constraint. So the VLT interferometer, with great effort, they have obtained enough UV coverage to get crude images at 2 microns of a few Herbig disks. And I think one reason we chose Herbig disks for these models is so that we could try to compare with those observational constraints. So I can just say something about the size and the shape of this inner rim, which is bright because it's right at the dust sublimation temperature.
Fine.
So I guess that will be getting much, much better starting now. There's a new instrument there called Gravity that will do this for many more fainter objects and with spectra simultaneously with, I guess anyways, it's the extent of my knowledge about it. There should be a lot more results from interferometry. Do you know what they see? So they see in continuum, they see this hot inner rim, but then there's also line emission in the infrared, so like bracket gamma emission. What is that? Does anyone know what that is?
Well, yeah, that's the issue. So because, you know, the question is how much comes from the inner disk, which is, you know, believed to be optical thin, but eventually it's not, right? There's enough line emission coming from this region. So this is actually the problem to really, you know, narrow down which emission comes from which region, right? But yeah, that's, well, in the next step, you know, we'll try to make, you know, to use these models and put it, you know, to VLTI modelers, you know, and if they can use this to constrain better.
And I guess I'd be curious, just in basics of, in a model where it's the inner disk, then do you expect that the line emission is smaller than the continuum, for instance? Does it come from a smaller radius, or should it be extended relative? And those are things that are immediately upon inspection of the data, I can tell you that. But then everything else, you know. Yeah, I mean, just, do you need something else basically beyond a disk? Do you need some outflow, or do you need something else? Or,
There was one line study, I think you did it at a journal club at JPL one time, I don't remember the author, but where they were saying there's some evidence for line emission from closer in than the sublimation front in one system.
Yes. Yeah, by looking at the visibility, right, they can somehow rule out, you know, which is coming from which part, and you're right, so they were seeing there's clearly something coming from the inner disk as well. That's true.
Yeah, it's very robust because you just look at the interferometric signature as a function of wavelengths. You don't need to calibrate any, you know, basically anything, and you can just say, is my continuum at higher visibility, so smaller scale, or is it the other way around? It's just very robust.
I know that these lines are often used as accretion diagnostics. They correlate with the UV excess.
Mm-hmm.
So, coming from quite far.
So we don't have a wind in these models. Maybe given this morning's discussion, it's worth thinking about how a photoevaporative wind would interact here. I think I was reminded of that by the fact that some of the interferometric people over the years have suggested that there's also a component that is not in the shape of a disk. So some people have said that Herbig stars need to have a halo. Other people say that maybe there's a wind launched from the inner edge, like Harrier Kronecker. and Hans is one of the students that said that. So there may be a third component in the system as well, which could be a wind. So it could be another situation where we have to tell between the disk that has turbulence in it and a wind.
So when you put in your vertical flux, do you get some sort of outflow?
Yes, it's actually very strong. So in this case, so, but you know, that is another problem because you know, if you lose a lot of mass, right? I mean, it changes constantly the optical thickness and has feedback on the radiation transfer. So therefore, you don't want to evolve the system too long and then make any conclusions because it's really hard. You know, I mean, this makes this vertical field really hard to model, right? And there are so many effects which then feedback, you know, on the radiation transfer and change the inner rim structure. So this is really tough. But we get something like a strong vertical, yeah, mass loading. So
which mechanism transports angular momentum then? Is it the outflow or is it the MRI?
Well, it's a combination, right? I mean, these models they're usually done with a completely outflow boundary, so everything with leaves, right? I mean, it's gone. But from the, if you calculate the stress, you know, at the midpoint, well, you can at least constrain what is the main, accretion stress in the bulk of the disk material, right? But how much the vertical field case is removed, we haven't checked, you know, by the wind. So
yeah, you need to open up your simulation domain all the way to near the pole in order to get the wind properly. That's extremely tough for a thin disk simulation.
Yes. Extremely tough is good. We call it impossible.
And do you don't see a wind when you have just the purely turbulent field?
There's even a wind if you have the zero net flux case, but it's much weaker. But again, you know, as Jun mentioned, you know, if you don't, you know, close up your domain, I mean, it's not really fair, you know, to say anything about the mass loss rate in this model.
So if you don't feel you can say much about the mass loss rate, I mean, is there any worry that the winds could actually be dynamically important for the rest of the simulation?
For the rest?
I mean, like, what's the ratio of m dot wind to m dot accretion?
Yeah. Well, what I can tell you for, it's not so strong that for, let's say, 200 orbits, it changed my surface density, let's say, by more than 5%. You know, so that we know, I mean, we measured that. So if it is there, right, it will affect on viscous times, probably, you know, the surface density evolution. So that we check, right? But anything else, you know.
Looks like we're out of questions. Thank you.
Thanks.